Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 94.
We're right in the court of a king. The three disciples, Wukong, Baji, and Sha Seng, have just arrived with their master, Tang Seng.
And the king's curious, I bet. These aren't your average visitors.
Not at all. He's curious, maybe a little bewildered. He wants to know, you know, the basics, names, where they're from, why monks, what scriptures are they after.
Seems simple enough.
You'd think. But this simple inquiry, it actually starts to unravel these incredible layers of celestial history, divine punishment.
It has to be Sun Wukong, right?
Who else? The Monkey King. So the king asks who they are, and Wukong just steps forward. No hesitation.
But not exactly following court etiquette, I imagine.
Not even close. He actually stops, sees his master Tang Seng is still standing, and basically tells the king off.
Really? What does he say?
Something like, "You're treating others lightly and yourself heavily. You've recruited my master as his son-in-law. How can he still be standing? He demands a seat for Tang Seng, calls him a Giren, a distinguished person."
Wow. Okay. That's bold. How does the king react?
He's stunned. The text says he almost falls off his throne. But he quickly orders a seat. Only then does Wukong introduce himself.
And the introduction itself is pretty grand, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Born from a stone, flower fruit mountain, water curtain cave, learned the great Tao, conquered dragons, wiped his name for the death ledger.
He literally rewrote his own fate.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
All leading up to that ultimate title he gave himself. Qitian Dasheng.
The great sage equal to heaven. I mean, that says it all. Pure celestial confidence.
Almost arrogance, you could say.
Yeah.
Which, you know, leads to the fall.
Right. The infamous disruption of the peach blossom feast.
That and just outright rebellion against heaven. It took the Buddha himself to step in and capture him.
And the punishment. It wasn't just a slap on the wrist.
No way. 500 years trapped under the Five Elements Mountain. Forced to eat iron pellets, drink molten copper, never tasting real food or drink.
It really underlines the seriousness of what he did. 5 centuries.
It's a huge price to pay. But eventually, Guanyin steps in, guides him towards redemption.
And Tenseng releases him, making him a disciple. Wukong.
Exactly. And the king, hearing all this, he's actually impressed. He recognizes the name, Ming Zong, a respected name. He even calls Tang Seng's arrival Hianan Yuan, heavenly destiny.
Like he suddenly gets the scale of who just walked into his palace.
Precisely. But Wukong's story is just the start. Next up is Zhu Baji.
Okay, Pigsy. His entrance must be different.
Very different. The text describes him as pursing his lips, showing off power. Later, he's like shaking his head, laughing really loudly. Tan Sang actually has to tell him to tone it down.
Huh. Sounds like Baji. But his backstory is a really surprising part for a lot of people, isn't it? He wasn't all...
A pig? No, not at all. He reveals he was actually human once.
A human? Really?
Yeah. Barely kind of lazy, enjoyed the good life, a bit chaotic, as the text says. But then he met a Zon Ren, a true immortal.
And got enlightened.
Just like that. Few words, apparently. He breaks free of his old ways, cultivates the Tao, and actually ascends to heaven.
So another one who went from mortal to divine.
Right. And not just any divine being. He became Marshal Tianpeng. Tianpeng Wanshui.
That sounds important.
It was. Commander of the river soldiers in heaven. A pretty high rank, living a comfortable celestial life.
Okay, so Marshal Tianpeng, living the good life. What went wrong?
Another rebellion.
Nope, something a bit more personal. Indulgent, maybe. It was at the same peach blossom feast. That party seems to be a trouble spot.
Seems like it. What did he do?
He got really drunk and decided to flirt rather aggressively with the moon goddess Changi.
Oh, dear. That probably didn't go over well.
Not at all. He got stripped of his rank, banished from heaven. And the worst part for him was the reincarnation. He ended up in the wrong womb.
And came out as a pig monster.
A pig monster on Fuling Mountain, causing, as the text says, endless evil.
Until Guanyin stepped in again.
Yep. Guided him towards Buddhism, protecting Tang Seng, gave him the name Wuneng, or Baji, as we usually call him.
Now, how does the king react to this story? If Wukong's tale impressed him, Baji's terrifies him. The text explicitly says he's Dimzan Sanjing, trembling with fear.
Wow. A former celestial general turned pig demon. I guess that would be unsettling.
You could say that. It really highlights the power these beings once had, and maybe still have, lurking underneath.
Okay, so we've had the defiant monkey king, the boastful pig marshal. Who's next? Sha Seng.
Sha Seng, yes. And he's quite different. Very calm, composed, comes forward, palms pressed together, very respectful.
Humble. But his past is just as significant, right?
Absolutely. Just revealed more quietly. He starts by saying he was also originally mortal.
Another one.
Yeah, seems to be a path. He sought the Tao to avoid reincarnation, wandered around, practiced diligently.
And made it to heaven.
He did. Achieved immortality, ascended, another success story initially.
And his job in heaven, was it as high-ranking as Marshal Tianping?
A different kind of importance. He was the Jianan Dajian, the Rolling Curtain General.
Rolling Curtain, what does that mean?
Basically, an attendant for the Jade Emperor's personal carriage, like high-level imperial staff, close to the center of power.
Okay, so respectable position. What on earth could he have done to get banished?
This is where it gets strange. And maybe speaks volumes about celestial justice or bureaucracy.
Don't tell me the peach blossom feast again.
You guessed it. Third time's the charm, or perhaps the curse.
Mm.
He accidentally broke a glass goblet. A bolizine.
He broke a cup. That's it.
That appears to be it. Accidentally dropped and broke a glass cup.
And for that, he gets banished.
Banished to the Flowing Sands River.
And he didn't just hang out there, right? He changed.
Yeah, his appearance became monstrous. And he also caused harm. Preyed on travelers trying to cross the river. Another fallen being causing trouble.
Until Guan Yin's intervention, yet again.
Yes, guiding him too. Telling him to wait for the pilgrim, Tang Sang, to achieve Gongzhang, the right enlightenment or fruition. He gets his place on the team and the name Wujing Xiaosang.
So the king has now heard all three stories, the rebel sage, the drunken marshal, the clumsy general. What's his final take?
It's a mix. A real roller coaster, as you said earlier. The text says much surprise, much joy, because, hey, his daughter's marrying a living Buddha, Tang Sang.
That's the upside.
But then simultaneously, surprise and fear, because he realizes these three disciples are essentially Yo Shen, demon gods.
Demon gods. Wow, that's quite a realization about your future son-in-law's travel companions.
Definitely puts a different spin on the pilgrimage. So the wedding's set for the 12th. Today's the 8th, a day deemed suitable for presenting worthy people. The king arranges for them to rest in the royal gardens.
Tang Sunzang and his disciples arriving at the imperial garden.
Mm-hmm.
They're settling down for a vegetarian feast. And if you know this group, you won't be surprised to find Zhu Baji just taking full advantage.
Oh, absolutely. Eating so much, he's literally, like, his gut is propped up. His belly's full.
It paints a very clear picture, doesn't it? A bit comical, really.
It does, but what's fascinating, I think, is how fast the tone shifts. You go from that, the mundane act of eating, almost, right into the core tension.
Yeah.
Because as night falls, they're getting ready for rest, and Tang Sanzang, our venerable master, pulls Sun Wukong aside.
And this isn't just a quiet word, is it?
No. No, it's clearly not friendly. He's absolutely fuming. Wukong accuses him of constantly causing trouble.
Right. Specifically for luring him to that colored pavilion earlier.
Exactly. Which has now landed him squarely in this predicament, this forced betrothal situation.
Wow. I mean, Tang Sanzang seems really pushed to his limit here. To say Wukong lured him, that's strong language, especially considering Wukong usually tries to protect him from this kind of stuff.
It really shows the depth of his frustration, yeah. But Wukong, well, he's always clever, isn't he? He has this multi-layered defense ready to go.
Okay, so what does he say?
He immediately brings up this really intriguing point. He suggests Tang Sanzang himself had Onwurjong.
A longing for the past, or like an appreciation for tradition.
Precisely. Because, Wukong points out, his own mother was said to have met her match by throwing an embroidered ball, just like the custom Tang Sanzang saw.
Ah, okay. So he's deflecting. It's a brilliant way to do it, actually.
It is. He's not just making excuses. He's kind of subtly flipping the script. And then he also mentions words from that elder from Jijubushinji Temple.
Implying there might have been some prophecy or some prior insight about this.
Possibly, yeah. It hints at something deeper. And then he revealed his own observation. He saw the king's face earlier and noted it had a somewhat dim or gloomy look.
Interesting.
Which instantly made Wukong want to see the princess himself, you know, to figure out what's really going on. Classic Wukong, always digging deeper.
Right. Always trying to see the reality behind the appearance. And this is where he brings up his special ability, isn't it?
Exactly. The fiery golden eyes.
These eyes, they let him see through falsehood, discern good from evil. Even see things like wealth and poverty, right? So they can act appropriately.
Mm-hmm. For anyone familiar with the story, these eyes aren't just like a superpower. They represent that ultimate clarity, spiritual perception.
The ability to see through the world's illusions, which is something Tang Sanzang, despite all his piety, often struggles with.
He really does. Wukong's eyes are critical here.
Yeah.
They're like the ultimate lie detector in a world full of demons and deception.
So while Baji and Xia Wujing are kind of teasing him, saying he's learn to read faces.
Yeah, they make a joke of it.
Tang Sanxian just shuts them down. He's focused. He presses Wukong. How are they going to handle this forced marriage? He needs a practical solution.
Understandably. So what is Wukong's plan to get them out of this royal mess?
Well, he suggests waiting. Waiting until the 12th day, the day of celebration.
Okay. Why then?
He figures the princess will appear then to pay respects to her parents, and that's when he'll observe her closely.
Makes sense. Get a good look, use the eyes.
Exactly. But then he just can't resist teasing the master.
Oh, boy.
He says, you know, if she turns out to be a real woman, Tang Sanxian could just become a lay the royal son-in-law.
Huh. Just settle down and enjoy the glory.
Yep. The sheer audacity.
Oh, that must have sent Tang Sanxian right over the edge.
Completely. He is enraged. He calls Wukong a good Husun, and you can really hear the mix of anger and maybe that grudging affection in that term.
Yeah, that exasperation.
He says Wukong is still harming him, especially now. He even quotes Baji, saying they've already completed 9/10 or 7/8 of the journey. They're so close.
The timing couldn't be worse for this kind of distraction.
And then comes the ultimate threat. He'll recite the tight fillet spell.
Ah, the headache spell. That always works.
Instantly, Wukong drops to his knees, bugging him not to.
So, okay. What's the real plan?
The real plan comes out then. If she is a true woman, Wukong says, they'll just all make a big fuss in the imperial palace during the wedding ceremony.
And just grab Tang Sanxian and leave. Basically, yeah. Classic Wukong. His solution is more chaos.
It really highlights the difference in their approaches, doesn't it? But somehow, Wukong's chaos usually gets results.
It does. It sets the stage for, well, future pandemonium. But it also shows Wukong's mix of cunning, trickery, and underneath it all, loyalty.
Right. So after that whole intense discussion, the night settles. And the description is quite beautiful. Falling darkness, floral scents, the quiet palace.
A moment of calm before the next storm, perhaps.
So the next morning, bright and early, the king's already holding court. And the description of the palace is pretty grand.
Yeah. Palace gates open, purple aura high, wind blowing imperial music through the azure sky. It really paints this picture of majesty order.
But we know there's this tension just underneath it all.
Absolutely. And amidst all this formality, the king makes an announcement. For the 12th day's joyful banquet, preparations are ordered.
Okay.
But for today, he invites the Yitang Sanxian to enjoy the imperial garden. Just him.
Trying to separate him from the disciples.
Seems like it. He instructs his officials to take the three wise relatives, Wukong, Baji, and Xiao Wujing, to a separate meeting hall. Arrange banquets for them there with music. Keep them busy, keep them separate.
Okay, but then Baji steps in, right? In his own unique way.
He does. He just brazenly interjects. Reminds the king, hey, the master and us, we've never been apart for a moment since we met.
Not exactly subtle.
Not at all. And then he explicitly asks for all of them to come to the imperial garden for 2 days.
And his reasoning.
He says it'll help his master become the son-in-law, adding, otherwise, this business deal won't work out.
A business deal? It's so crude, but does it work? How does the king react to Baji?
It's pretty amazing. The king clearly finds Baji, well, ugly and crude. The text even notes his mannerisms, twisting his head, puckering his mouth, shaking his ears like he has a wind sickness or something.
But not exactly courtly behavior.
Definitely not. But the king seems really worried about upsetting the marriage plans. He seems almost desperate for this to happen.
So he gives in.
Partially, yeah. He concedes. Orders 2 tables for himself and Tang Sanxian in one pavilion, the Everlasting Peace and Harmony Pavilion.
Okay.
And 3 tables for the disciples in another, the Spring Retention Pavilion. He cites concerns about seating arrangements, but really?
He's accommodating Baji's demand, just keeping them slightly separate.
Exactly. Baji's bluntness, surprisingly, worked. It really highlights how urgently the king wants this marriage, maybe even sacrificing some royal dignity for it.
Interesting. And Baji's reaction?
Surprisingly polite, for once. He actually thanks the king.
Huh. Wonders never cease.
Right. And then the king issues more commands, telling palace officials to prepare another banquet, this time for the women of the court, empresses, concubines, the princess.
Getting ready for the wedding.
Yep. To dress her hair and add dowry, getting everything set for the grand marriage on the 12th.
It really does make you wonder, why is the king so incredibly eager for this? Going along with Baji's weird request.
There's definitely a sense of urgency, isn't there? Maybe some hidden agenda under all the ceremony.
Could be. So around mid-morning, the king personally escorts Tang Sanxian to the imperial garden.
Setting the stage. Seems like a pleasant outing, but you can feel that underlying tension. The spiritual journey is about to face this beautiful, maybe dangerous distraction.
And now, yeah, the text just gives us this incredible gift, a truly lush, almost poetic description of the imperial garden itself.
It's more than just setting, isn't it? It feels like a character. So vibrant, so sensory.
Totally. We read about pathways paved with colored stones, railings carved with borders lined with strange flowers and plants.
It is fascinating how it emphasizes smell, not just sight. Step and feel the subtle fragrance fill the sleeve, and walk and get the clear scent on the clothes.
Wow.
The garden is just teeming with life. Peaches confusing emeralds, tender willows flashing yellow orioles. It feels deliberately enchanting, doesn't it? Almost like a beautiful trap.
Yeah, a trap of beauty. And we get glimpses of these grand places too. Phoenix Terrace, Dragon Pool, suggests grandeur, maybe even mythical stuff.
Right, where phoenixes are drawn by flutes and fish transform into dragons. And then you have the more literary spots.
Like the Bamboo Pavilion for poetry, the Pine Studio for scholarly collections. It suggests this place of deep cultivation, refinement, makes the temptation feel even stronger somehow.
And that detail, it isn't just filler. It tells you so much about the culture, the wealth of this kingdom. You see these meticulously crafted landscapes.
Rock gardens with emerald-like rocks, winding streams with deep green waves.
And the sheer variety of flowers is just staggering. Peonies, roses, jasmine, begonias, hollyhocks, pears, apricots, orchids, magnolias. It goes on and on.
A whole catalog of beautiful blooms. And described with such vivid language, like red as rouge cheeks, fragrant as brocade surrounded, the narrative really emphasizes how the east wind returns the warm sun, making the whole garden display its charm and glory. It's this beautiful, almost overwhelming picture, a really lavish scene for the drama that's unfolding around Tang Sanzang's predicament.
The garden itself becomes a test, doesn't it? Beautiful, seductive test of their resolve. The language used is really rich, like you really get a sense of this grandeur, right? Magnificent palace gates born with dawn's light, phoenix and dragon towers covered in auspicious mist. It pulls you right in.
Yeah, it's very immersive. And what's quite telling right away is how the group gets split up. It subtly shows you the different levels of treatment. The king personally takes Tang Monk off to the Huayige. That's for a much more formal, you know, high status banquet. But Sun Wukong, Zhu Baji, and Xiao Wuxing, they get sent to the Lu Chun Ting. Seems like a more, let's say, relaxed spot for their own feast.
Ah, so different settings for different folks, even in a welcome.
Exactly. A clear difference in formality from the get-go.
And even with all this celebration, this respect from the king, the text tells us something crucial about Tang Monk's state of mind. It says he was duo.
Outwardly happy, but inwardly worried.
Right. So he looks pleased, but inside he's anxious. What does that tell us about him here, surrounded by all this luxury?
Well, I think it's a fantastic glimpse into his complexity. It shows he's not just, you know, swept away by it all. Even on this huge spiritual mission, he's still got human anxieties, maybe worries about the quest or where this whole royal thing is leading. It makes him feel very real.
Yeah, definitely adds layers. Okay, so from that inner turmoil, things take a really surprising turn, don't they? Tang Monk's in the Huayige, and he spots these four beautiful golden screens. Each one has a poem about a season: spring, summer, autumn, winter.
And not just any poems. They're by Tongkrik scholars from the Hanlin Academy. We're talking top-tier literary figures.
So this isn't just dinner and drinks. It's a cultural event.
Precisely. It raises the stakes, intellectually speaking.
And the king sees Tang Monk admiring the poems. And then he throws down a challenge. He even calls him a
son-in-law
already. And asked him to compose matching poems, same rhyme scheme and everything. So what happens? What does this reveal?
It's brilliant, actually. It contrasts so much with the usual image we have of him, the sort of worried pilgrim. Here we see the scholar emerge. The text says he was C-E. Basically, seeing the beautiful scenery made him forget his troubles and reveal his true nature. And he just jumps right in. Starts with C-E, the sun warms, ice thaws, earth balances. It suggests his true nature includes this artistic, learned side.
That's fascinating. So it's not just about piety. There's this deep, scholarly, almost artistic core to him.
Exactly. And he nails it, writes poems for all four seasons.
And the king is impressed.
Oh, absolutely delighted. Especially by one line, apparently. Tea take with sleeves folded, singing aloud by the green railing.
Wow. So a moment of unexpected poetic flair from the monk.
A really different side of him shines through.
Okay, so while Tang Monk is wowing the king with poetry, what's going on back at the Lu Chin Ting with the disciples? I have a feeling it's a bit different over there.
Oh, worlds apart. No poetry recitals there. They're having a much more, shall we say, boisterous time.
Mm-hmm.
And Zhu Baji, true to form, after stuffing himself, basically announces he needs a nap. He uses this really earthy proverb, like, which roughly means, if you don't lie down like a corpse after eating, your belly won't get properly fat.
Uh-huh. Classic Baji. So subtle.
Not exactly courtly manners, no.
So when Tang Monk finally gets back to them, how does that go down? He must have been horrified.
You can imagine. He immediately starts scolding them for being so loud and rowdy in a royal palace. He's worried they'll offend the king, you know, still very aware of their position as guests.
But Baji probably doesn't see it that way.
Not at all. He fires back with this great line, something like, "You can't beat kinship apart. You can't scold neighborliness away." He's basically saying, "Hey, we're practically family now."
Oh, that's bold. How does Tang Monk react to that?
He's had enough. Orders Sun Wukong, the Monkey King, to grab his staff and give Baji a beating for being so disrespectful. Which leads to Baji immediately backtracking, yelling, "Ah, son-in-law, grandfather, spare me, spare me."
Son-in-law, grandfather. That's hilarious. The dynamics never change, do they?
Never. And even after he's spared, Baji can't resist muttering under his breath.
What does he say?
Something like, "My conscience," which means good noble, good son-in-law. The wedding hasn't even happened, and you're already acting like the king's law.
Perfect. It just perfectly captures their whole relationship, even amidst royal splendor. That friction is always there.
Absolutely. And this sort of playful chaos leads us toward the main event of their stay. After about 3 or 4 days of this feasting and poetry and, well, Baji being Baji, on the 12th day, the officials announce everything's ready. The son-in-law's official residence is prepared, dowry is sorted, and the wedding banquet is set. Get this. Kiroche.
500 tables, meat and vegetarian options. Wow. That's enormous. No expense spared.
Immense. Really drives home how serious the king is about this marriage.
And the king must be thrilled, ready to finally get the wedding underway.
Exactly. The text says he's just about to go invite his Tang Monk to the feast. The moment seems to have arrived. But then, just in the nick of time, there's an interruption.
Oh, what happens?
The queen, the other royal consorts, and the princess herself summon the king. They call him away to the Ziyang Palace.
Ah, a delay. So Tang Monk isn't immediately dragged to the altar. Adds a bit of suspense there.
Definitely. And the description of that palace, the Ziyang Palace, is even more over the top. Phrases like "aya," like a riot of flowers and brocade. It's compared to a "tingyu," a heavenly moon palace, or a celestial jade palace.
Okay, so we're talking almost divine levels of beauty and luxury now, setting quite the stage.
For sure. And just to hammer the point home, there are 4 new poems presented there. These are called Yu De Sufir, Joyful Meeting of Good Marriage Poems. And they basically heap praise on the princess, saying things like, "That how can Qing Yu, the moon goddess, even compare? And Yu De Suth, Xi'an Gulmors."
So intense flattery, really building up the desirability of this match from the royal perspective. The pressure on Tang Monk must be immense at this point. And the king, he is just ecstatic, over the moon.
Completely.
His princess chose the holy monk, Tang Monk,
yeah,
you know, by throwing that celebratory ball. And he's eager, like really eager to get on with the wedding. He says, "This is the auspicious day. Don't miss the hour."
Yeah.
It's full speed ahead for him.
But then you get this twist, a really unexpected one. The princess comes to her father, bows really low, asks forgiveness for 10,000 crimes.
10,000. What did she do?
Well, her reason is she says she heard from palace officials that the Tang Monk's disciples, the other 3, are extremely ugly, like terrifyingly so.
Mm-hmm.
And she's afraid to even see them. She actually pleads with the king, send them out of the city so they don't, you know, startle and harm her delicate body.
Her delicate body. Right. And the king.
Yeah.
What's his reaction?
He just complies almost instantly. He's like, "Oh, right. Their ugliness. I almost forgot."
You forget.
Apparently.
Mm.
So he immediately decides, okay, grant their travel permit, give them provisions, the hue, and send them off quick smart, off to Spirit Mountain to see the Buddha.
But the Tang Monk stays, the son-in-law.
Exactly, he stays. And the princess is naturally very grateful. But you have to ask, right, this quick compliance, It feels like more than just convenience.
Yeah, it feels like it highlights something, maybe a weakness. Like the king's blind spot for his daughter, maybe.
Precisely. And that's what Wukong picks up on later. It sets the stage perfectly for a deception built on these, well, perceived weaknesses and maybe hidden motives. What's the princess really playing at here?
Good question. Is it just vanity or something else?
I think it's definitely more than just a simple objection. It feels very deliberate, calculated even. The king's eagerness to please her, combined with how quickly he dismisses the disciples, it just lays the perfect groundwork for Wukong's countermove.
So Wukong sees this isn't just about looks.
Right. He suspects she has a very specific reason for wanting the Tang monk isolated.
Okay, so the decree is made. The disciples are supposedly leaving. How's the Tang monk taking all this? Because the king's celebrating. But he must be.
Oh, he's the opposite of celebrating. He's been counting the days, apparently just filled with anxiety, wondering how on earth he's going to deal with this situation. He's completely stressed out.
Understandably. So this is where Wukong steps in.
This is exactly where Wukong's, you know, brilliance really comes to the fore. He gets the seriousness of it immediately. He even says he senses the king's ill fortune. The
Huiki. What's that exactly?
It's more than just bad luck. It's like a palpable negative energy, an atmosphere of impending trouble. It's a sort of spiritual intuition Wukong has.
Okay.
But crucially, he also notes it has not yet touched the Tang monk directly. So it's not an immediate, overwhelming danger yet.
Right.
But here's the key condition for him acting. He needs to see the princess himself. He has to figure out her true or false nature. He's not just going to rush in. He needs intelligence first.
Smart. Get the lay of the land.
Exactly. So he tells the Tang monk very confidently, don't worry, just agree. Go along with being sent off. He promises he'll, you know, use his magic and come right back to protect him closely.
And just then, the officials arrive. Talk about timing.
Perfect timing. They arrive to summon the disciples for their departure. And of course, Baji, well, he gets excited.
About leaving.
About the send-off. He's already dreaming of thousands of taels of gold and silver as a parting gift, thinking they can use it to buy some gifts and maybe visit his in-laws on the way back, always thinking of his stomach or his wallet.
Uh-huh. Classic Baji. But Shaoseng.
Shaoseng, he's the practical one. He immediately tells Baji, essentially, shut up, don't talk nonsense. He says, just, you know, let Wukong, the older brother, handle it.
Yeah.
And that little exchange, it just perfectly shows you their different personalities,
mm-hmm.
right? Baji's all about the immediate material stuff. Shaoseng is cautious, reliant on Wukong. And Wukong, he's playing the long game, strategically.
It's a great character snapshot. So now comes the actual farewell.
The performance.
Yeah,
exactly. Performance. They bring their luggage, the horse, everything to the palace. The king asks for the travel permit. He stamps it. And then he gives them this quite significant family gift. The Hu. 10 ingots of gold, 20 of silver.
And I bet Baji.
You guessed it. Baji steps right up to take the money.
Mm-hmm.
Predictable.
Mm-hmm.
Wukong, though, he plays his part perfectly. Just a curt bow, a quick thank you, and turns to leave immediately. Very convincing. Almost too convincing.
Too convincing. How so?
Because the Tang monk actually believes it for a second. He completely panics. The text says he like scrambles up. It's this frantic, clumsy movement born of pure fear.
Oh, wow.
He grabs Wukong and through gritted teeth, he cries out, you're all leaving me and going. You can just feel his absolute desperation in that moment.
That's intense. So Wukong has to reassure him, but secretly.
Right. And this is masterful. Wukong squeezes his master's palm, gives him a wink, a secret signal, and whispers, you enjoy yourself happily here. We will get the scriptures and come back to see you.
Ah, okay. So a hidden message amidst the drama.
Precisely. And the beauty is all the officials watching, they just see the public drama.
Yeah.
They witness this interaction and think it's a completely genuine, sorrowful farewell.
So the deception works on multiple levels.
Perfectly. The Tang monk, now understanding, or at least trusting Wukong has a plan, he has to maintain the act. He finally lets go of Wukong. The king invites the son-in-law back into the hall, tells the officials to escort the other three out. It's this amazing blend of public spectacle and private communication.
Wow. Okay, so the three disciples head out with the officials. Is Baji still confused?
He is. As they leave the palace gates, he actually asks Wukong, are we? Are we really leaving?
And Wukong?
Says nothing. Stays silent. He leads them to an inn. The innkeeper welcomes them.
And then what's the plan now they're outside?
Wukong gives very specific orders. Tells Baji and Shaoseng, stay here. Do not show your faces under any circumstances. Tells them if the innkeeper asks anything, just be vague. Answer vaguely. And crucially, don't talk to me.
Don't talk to him. Why?
Because Wukong's about to do his thing. He plucks a single hair from his body, blows on it with his immortal breath, and commands it, change, and poof, the hair transforms into an exact duplicate of Wukong.
A clone, to stay with him at the end.
Exactly. The clone stays with Baji and Shaosing. Then Wukong's true body just flashes up into the air and transforms again.
Into what this time?
Into a bee, a tiny, clever bee.
A bee?
Yeah.
That's unexpected. Why a bee specifically? Is there more to it than just being small and sneaky?
Oh, definitely. The source gives this really vivid, almost poetic description of the bee. It says, yellow wings, sweet mouth, sharp tail, flying wildly with the wind, a most capable of picking stamens and stealing fragrance, drifting through willows and flowers. It talks about how it works hard making honey but never tastes it, only leaving behind its reputation.
Hmm. So what's the symbolism there?
Well, think about it. The bee is small, easily overlooked, right? But it can get anywhere, into the most private spaces, picking stamens and stealing fragrance. That's Wukong infiltrating the palace.
Gathering intelligence, like nectar.
Exactly. Gathering the nectar information, the means to fix the crisis. But he doesn't benefit directly. He doesn't taste the honey himself. He's the facilitator working behind the scenes for the mission, just leaving behind his reputation for being clever and getting things done. It's a perfect metaphor for his role here.
That's brilliant. Okay, so the bee Wukong flies back.
Gently flies into the court. And inside, there's the Tang monk sitting on an embroidered stool next to the king, just frowning with a troubled heart, still completely stressed and isolated.
Understandably.
And here comes the crucial moment. The bee flies right up to the Tang monk's hat, the Varrocana hat, which is significant in itself, a symbol of enlightenment.
Right.
It crawls quietly to his ear and whispers, just one simple message. Master, I'm here. Don't worry.
Wow, just that.
Just that, but it's everything. And the source makes a point of saying, only Tang monk heard this. Those ordinary mortals never imagined they would perceive it. It's a completely secret reassurance.
And the effect on Tang monk?
Instant relief. The text says he immediately felt at ease. That one whisper just completely changes his mental state. It's the power of knowing you're not alone, even when it seems like you are.
That psychological comfort, it's huge in a crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Just knowing help is nearby, even unseen.
Absolutely critical. It shifts him from despair back to a state where he can, you know, hold it together and trust the plan, whatever it is. That unseen presence is his anchor.
But the situation hasn't actually changed yet, right? The danger is still there.
No, the outward situation is still perilous. Mm-hmm. And the clock is ticking. Because soon after this, palace officials come in. They announce the blissful wedding feast. The shoop is ready.
Oh, boy.
It's prepared in the shoot. The Jiang Palace and the queen and princess are waiting. They invite the king and the noble person, that's the Tang monk, to go meet the family.
Meet the family?
Mm-hmm.
Under these circumstances. This is getting tense.
Extremely. The king, of course, is still full of joy. He happily goes into the inner palace with his son-in-law, the Tang monk.
And that's where the chapter leaves us hanging.
Pretty much. The source ends with this really potent couplet. The evil lord loves the flower, but the flower brings disaster. The Zen mind is moved, and thoughts breed sorrow.